Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
That's my little gift to you, my fellow boomers.
Today's show is about niceness.
It's born in 1954. How am I not going to play that song? All right, so today, while working on the show in my home office, I asked the Amazon Echo unit, better known as Alexa, "Alexa, are you nice?" And she answered, and I do a fairly good Alexa, "I like to show kindness whenever I can." And I thought at that moment that Alexa and I, as we so often do, had gotten right to the razor's edge of one of the questions inherent in a show like this one, which is, are niceness and kindness the same things? I think I've come to the conclusion that niceness is a little bit more performative. It requires an audience. It's sort of, it's quantum, right? If we don't identify it, if we don't see it, if nobody sees it, it doesn't really exist in that state. Niceness is a way you act. You act nice. Kindness is an act. You do something that is kind. Okay, class dismissed. You can all go home. No, we are going to have a full show about this and people much more learned than I, starting with Carrie Tirado Brayman, a professor at the University of Buffalo and the author of the book American Niceness, A Cultural History. So first of all, Carrie, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Colin. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I don't know, what do you think about that keenly reasoned distinction that I just made?
Yeah, it's one that comes up a lot, that niceness is superficial and kindness is genuine. And one can fake niceness, but kindness is more difficult to do and it's more authentic. But I've been thinking about that a lot. And kindness can be a gesture as well. It could also be disingenuous and self-motivated. So I think I want to take heart in Emerson's quote that we live amid surfaces and the true art of life is to skate well on them. That niceness is important precisely because it is superficial. And those little gestures, those daily interactions of have a nice day, have a really important role to play in our everyday lives. So I think kindness and niceness are both important. I think they're at different registers, but they can also be authentic and fake as well. It really depends on context.
Well, you get extra points for quoting Emerson. I like Emerson. one of the catalyzing moments for you is right after 9/11, George W. Bush is our president, and he gives a speech to a session of Congress. This is A1 Cat. Let's hear this.
Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what they see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedoms. Our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other.
So explain why that got you thinking in this direction.
Yeah, it was that, but also the pervasiveness of that question beyond George Bush. I remember an educated neighbor of mine saying to me, how could one of the potential hijackers or was alleged to have lived in Buffalo, how could he have lived in our community and still want to kill us? And so this question of why do they hate us was fascinating for me, more interesting than the answer, to be honest, because it personalizes the political. It takes a complicated structural political context of foreign policy and international relations and reduces it to liking, hating, jealousy, which is George Bush's response, And it's the opposite of the feminist slogan of the 1970s, which is to politicize the personal, not to personalize the political. And what it does, furthermore, I think, is it makes Americans the object of hate, but not the actual haters. We're the innocent victims of other people's wrath, but we don't ourselves do the hating.
You know, I think about all this in relation to your work, but I also I'm thinking a lot about Bush. So famously, on the day that we were attacked, Bush was in a classroom and he was reading aloud from a reading exercise called The Pet Goat. And the story goes anyway that he didn't stop and he didn't get up and run out of the room because he didn't want to alarm these elementary school students. He kind of stayed with what he was doing. They could read his face, apparently, and could understand that something very serious was happening, but he didn't want to do that, which is sort of a nice guy thing to do. And when we think about our presidents, Carrie, it's interesting. I think we are looking for niceness or something that resembles niceness. You know, his father, Bush 41, promised in 1988 a kinder, gentler America, leading Nancy Reagan to say, kinder and gentler than who? That was the predecessor. 4 years later, Bush 41 loses to Clinton, who really out-niced him in that famous town hall. He never actually said, I feel your pain, but he did take several steps towards the woman asking the question and really kind of, you know, made an effort to validate her as a person and treat her as a person and ask follow-up questions. And then Bush 43 won because he was the kind of guy that people could imagine having a beer with. You know, we crave at least the surface of niceness, I think, in our political leaders. But I'd love to hear you respond.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, campaigning and kissing babies and that kind of thing. In the British context, for instance, a prime minister doesn't campaign in terms of buying everyone McDonald's burgers. I think that Clinton did at one point, or kissing babies. It's not registered at that interpersonal level. But you're absolutely right that in this country, and this illustrates American niceness perfectly. In fact, one could write an article, Presidential Niceness, that these gestures of the interpersonal are absolutely pivotal. And we see that with President Biden. He's seen as a benign, grandfatherly type who loves his ice cream, right? And Jill Biden told us recently he loves chocolate chip ice cream. So these kinds of details really kind of feed a longer tradition on presidential niceness and the importance of likability in this country.
You know, the other thing that struck me is that Michelle Obama tells a story. It actually was captured on camera that they were, I think, maybe at a funeral or something. And she usually sits near W because of the order of the formers. And she needed a cough drop or wanted a cough drop. And you could see him passing one to Laura that was getting over to Michelle. And she sort of says that that's her relationship with him. They couldn't be more different politically. I think W was a guy who actually is kind of nice and is kind of kind. He had people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld to be the flamethrowers. But I feel like, you know, it is how people are and then the policies they implement are not identical to one another, maybe particularly in the area of niceness.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that really fascinates me, this disconnect between interpersonal niceness and the actions that they foster, encourage, and elicit. For instance, you know, would the Afghanis consider George Bush nice? Would the Iraqis consider George Bush nice? So the focus on the interpersonal, I think, is a way to bracket off American niceness from violence and from the consequences of their policies.
I saw this also a little bit in the movie Oppenheimer. So, and I don't think this is a historically documentable scene, but there's a scene where, you know, Oppenheimer kind of realizes what has happened, and we watch the necessity of making a bomb to fight the Nazis with vanishes with the collapse of the Nazis. But, you know, after the bomb is dropped, he's in there with Truman and he says, I feel like I have blood on my hands. And Truman, you know, makes a sort of joke of offering him a Kleenex tissue and then says, you think anyone in Hiroshima or Nagasaki gives a bleep who built the bomb? They care who dropped it. I did. Hiroshima isn't about you. He leaves and we see Truman say, don't let that crybaby back in here. And I mean, you know, yeah. I'd rather have you unpack it, actually. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's a really pivotal scene. And as a historical footnote, some of his major generals advised him not to drop the bomb mm-hmm. because the Japanese were getting ready to surrender in the next 2 weeks. So there was controversy even within the cabinet about dropping the bomb. There was no consensus. But I do think that that gesture in the movie, I remember that, shows the kind of iron fist behind niceness, right? That it is this kind of surface affect that can conceal horrific crimes. But if I can follow up, what interests me about that particular moment, this goes outside of Oppenheimer, is in the aftermath of the bombing of Hiroshima, what did the U.S. government do but invite the Hiroshima maidens, young women who had been disfigured from the bomb, to the United States to have plastic surgery? And this was on the cover of Life magazine, how these young Japanese women would have the important surgery to make them pretty again. And that for me is an absolute snapshot of American niceness after this horrific act of violence.
That is a beautiful, I mean, there's so much that's there as a metaphor. It's kind of like we break all your crockery. Now here's some crazy glue to help you put it back together again. So I think another thing that's true here in America, I mean, as you have suggested, we think of ourselves as nice. We think of ourselves as beneficent. We think of ourselves as the people who show up and help. That is not always the case. I think also in our interpersonal interactions and in our culture, there's an exaltation of niceness, especially feminine niceness. I know that you mentioned Louisa May Alcott and Harriet Beecher Stowe, who lived a few blocks from where I'm sitting right now. Say a little bit about what you see in all that.
Yeah, Alcott was wonderful because what she did was she juxtaposed American niceness of American girl niceness versus the nastiness of English women. And I think she kind of admired the nastiness of English women, that all of her characters, her American characters, had to be painstakingly nice. And whenever she wrote her Gothic fiction under a pseudonym about nasty women in power and all that, they were always British. So I think British women allowed her that characterization to show women's aggressivity and shadow side, if you will. But yeah, I do think feminine niceness has been a kind of behavioral corset for women, you know, dating, you know, way back before Alcott, and certainly still persists today. Just looking at books, nice women don't get the corner office. And there was an article in Bloomberg last year, Nikki Haley is too nice to be president. So, you know, women and niceness is still a very conflictual relationship. And I don't think we're ready yet for women to show a not nice aspect of themselves, particularly if they're public figures.
Can we talk about men and niceness? There have been studies that suggest that women will respond to the question of whether or not they want a nice guy. They will say yes, but don't choose them in their real dating life. There is that kind of idea that the bad guy, the alpha male, whatever, winds up being more attractive no matter what people say. Do you have a take on that?
Oh, yes, that's an old dynamic as well, that women desire the bad boy. And I think that's still an ongoing conflict that's happening today with young women. You know, you can go on to Twitter and follow the various debates. You know, Taylor Swift songs have various lyrics matching this conflict as well. Yeah, it's an ongoing one. And I think women, I don't want to make huge generalizations, but I think straight women, you know, do need to interrogate that kind of ideal of masculine desirability. And I think Zoomers, in contrast to Boomers, are doing that, to be honest. But we'll see what kind of impact. I do think American masculinity is changing for Zoomers, but change is slow as well.
You write that the Declaration of Independence, to whatever degree it's a breakup letter, is couched rather nicely. I mean, for a statement of rebellion anyway. Say something about that.
Oh my gosh, the Declaration of Independence is rhetorically in the passive voice when it becomes necessary. And they are reluctant revolutionaries. In fact, Jefferson really wanted a rapprochement with Britain. He did not want to go to war as late as 1775. And I think the Declaration really resonates with that tone of wistfulness. It's unfortunate. We could have been great together, I think Jefferson wrote in an earlier draft, which the committee excised. And it's almost like a failed bromance, to be honest, a transatlantic bromance that didn't happen. In contrast, Thomas Paine in Common Sense has this active, fiery rhetoric looking to the future rather than the past and saying, you know, burn the palaces, and full of the active voice command. So absolutely, the Declaration of Independence is really a very careful document that is reluctant rhetorically as well as in tone.
I feel as though this is something we keep returning to, that there's kind of a double narrative here, that, yes, we are a nice nation. We are the people who come to help. And yes, we will drop an atomic bomb on you, whether that's militarily necessary or not. And I think it's kind of there in our culture a lot. I grew up hearing the Leo Durocher line, which he also never actually said in the first place, nice guys finish last. And I think as you go on through the 80s and 90s, you start to see the exaltation of businessmen like Lee Iacocca and Jack Welch, these guys who they're just crushing it by crushing it. You know? And so for all of our talk of niceness, when you look at sort of who we reward and who we value, it seems like it's maybe more of that and less of, you know, just some nice Unitarian minister with some lovely thing to say.
Yeah, and that could be because it appeals to the media in a certain way. I'm thinking of Elon Musk as a contemporary example. what are the stories that aren't being told necessarily? And one thing that comes to mind is, I don't know if you remember, December 2016, Wes Clark Jr. is one of the protesters at Standing Rock, with the water protectors. And he creates this powerful ceremony as a veteran of the U.S. Army with other veterans. And in the gymnasium after dinner, there's hundreds of people there. And he, wearing the uniform of the 7th Cavalry, kneels down in front of the Lakota Sioux elders saying, the U.S. Army took your land. They polluted your earth. They, you know, decimated your culture. And we beg for your forgiveness. And people, these are veterans of the U.S. Army, are bawling, men and women. It is an incredibly powerful moment. And when I share this moment with others, they can't believe it was never on the news. There was never any publicity about it. So I would just follow up with your question, what gets seen and what doesn't? Because this gesture of what I call regeneration through niceness was incredibly powerful.
That is, nice guys don't make headlines, at least not the way bad guys do. Do you think there is a significant paradigm shift? I mean, I think George W. Bush, whose policies frequently appalled me, you can make a case that he is, in his other life, a nice guy, and that he needed to at least be plausibly a nice guy. You look at some of the subsequent elections, I think that's been true over and over again. In 2016, things do seem to shift. And I know that you have Trump claiming that he's a nice guy, but I don't think anybody really thinks of this man as a nice guy. And that seems less important at this moment somehow.
Yeah, and it's true. His campaign now very rarely uses, hey, I'm a likable guy. I'm nice. Really, I am. I won't be nasty to people. That's an actual quote in 2016. You're right. I think the veneer has been peeled off and he doesn't have to pretend anymore. Right. People know what they're getting. And I think this Trump at this moment represents this disconnect between not nice and still being likable. Right. His fan base is still supporting him because he's likable. They see him as a kind of nasty guy with a sense of humor. So I think you're absolutely right. We are at a crossroads right now. And by the same token, I don't think the benign grandfatherly image of Biden is working either. So the presidential niceness script is absolutely running out of steam, and it's also changing with Trump's second campaign.
Yeah, we have a different kind of appetite now, and I think you're very, very correct to emphasize the funny part of it, the sense of humor part of it. There's something funny about Trump, even if you don't like him. And you know, when you look at the world of cringe comedy, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm is coming back for its final season. I mean, Larry David's made a career of being a not nice person who somehow or other allows us to, I don't know, park a whole bunch of things or project a whole bunch of things from ourselves onto him. Or I don't know. There's some, you know, Faustian bargain that's going on as we embrace these not very nice characters.
And think of Archie Bunker, too. You mentioned the boomer generation. And he himself, he was abhorrent views, right? But yet extremely likable. And you had compassion for him as well.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I really enjoy your work, and you're a terrific guest on the radio. Carrie Tirado Braman is a professor at the University of Buffalo, where they're not really nice to the Kansas City Chiefs, no matter what you hear, and author of the book American Niceness, A Cultural History. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Colin.
Okay. We'll take a little break. We'll be back.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Takes a moment to show somebody that you care, to show somebody that you care. In the world that we live in, everybody wants to be so cool, me in the in crowd, got the hottest clothes.
All right, so that's India Arie kind of summing up the research that we're about to present here. Before we get into this, let me just say one thing that I thought about a lot as we got ready for this show is, you know, is niceness adaptive? Is there any kind of reason to be nice? One of the more gripping episodes of This American Life recently involved a wildlife researcher, a naturalist named Rick McIntyre, who studies wolves in Yellowstone. And he has a book called The Rise of Wolf 8. Wolf 8 was this kind of somewhat runty, but really nice. The word nice came up a lot in discussing him. A nice wolf. And it turned out that it kind of paid off. We also know that bonobos, will share with anyone. They prefer to share with a stranger rather than a roommate, which is kind of interesting. That must be adaptive in some way. So on the other hand, you know, we talked about nice guys finish last. There's kind of that attitude, too. So unfortunately, some researchers have really looked at the question of what happens when we're nice? What happens when we're kind? One of those researchers is Amit Kumar, assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. Amit is joining us right now. Welcome to the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
So niceness feels like a flabby, not particularly clinical or scientific term. It's not really the term you use. The term you use is kindness. But do you want to talk about, in either case, what are we talking about?
Sure, yeah. We look at, you know, we refer to them as random acts of kindness because I think people can intuitively understand what that means. But obviously, as people that are studying these ideas scientifically, we're looking at very specific things. And so the more jargony way that we might talk about this is sometimes pro-social action. And so what is a pro-social action? It's essentially some sort of other-oriented act that shows some care for others. It's done with the intention of making someone else feel positive. So the idea here is that these are behaviors that are intended primarily to benefit another person. So the ones that we study in our research are sort of unexpected pro-social acts that you could do for someone else. They tend to be interpersonally warm. They're done out of kindness towards another person without any expectation of receiving something in return from from the recipient of your act.
All right, so let's get our hands dirty with hot chocolate and delve into one of your studies here. This is really fascinating. Explain the hot chocolate study.
Sure, yeah. This is one that I think sticks out in people's memories because you can envision it pretty easily, even when I ramble my way through describing it. Essentially, what we were doing here is we had a participant in one of our studies. We conducted multiple studies, but in one of them, we had them perform a random act of kindness for just a stranger who happened to be nearby. So this wasn't somebody that they already knew. This was done at an ice skating rink in a public park. And we had these participants at this park giving away hot chocolate on sort of a cold winter's day to someone else in the area. And what we did is we asked them essentially to predict how the recipient of this kind act would feel. And then we measured how the recipient actually felt. And the interesting thing that we discovered was that these park-goers indicated that receiving a hot chocolate was in fact a much more positive experience than performers of that very act of kindness expected. So people tend to underestimate the value of these random acts of kindness.
I mean, it kind of makes a heuristic sense, right? That the person benefiting, particularly if the person benefiting really kind of needed or wanted the thing, they are going to place a higher value on it. It's a pretty small thing to, you know, to just offer a little kindness, but it might be, it kind of makes sense. It tracks, as they say. So one of the other things you looked at is sort of chain reactions or the downwind effects of kindness. Tell us a little bit about what you learned there.
Yeah, so there are a bunch of things that we looked at. One thing that I didn't mention with that hot chocolate study is we also, and in many studies that we conducted, we also look at how the performers of these actions feel. And it turns out that being kind to another person also makes the performers of these acts happier. So in that sense, both parties are benefiting from these actions. But as you suggested, it turns out that even third parties can benefit from these sorts of exchanges as well through what you might think of as sort of indirect reciprocity. So this was another experiment we did. It was a little complicated, but essentially we had people engaging in one of these pro-social exchanges or not. So there were two people involved in that sort of exchange. And what we did is then we then had recipients of an item as a result of an act of kindness or not, then play another economic game, essentially. This was to explore what you might call sort of pay it forward effects. It turns out generosity can be contagious, as you were suggesting, and we were interested in empirically studying that. So receivers of these pro-social acts can pay kindness forward. Another interesting thing that we were looking at here, in line with what we were discussing just a moment ago, was sort of testing whether performers of that initial act anticipate that sort of downstream behavioral consequence. So essentially, they're causing the more generous behavior in the person that they're initially helping, but they don't seem to realize that. They don't seem to recognize that. It turns out that participants in the study were in fact more generous to an anonymous third party, someone that they'd never meet, where they could, they basically had the option of allocating some money between themselves and another person. They could do this however they wanted, keep all of it, give some of it. The people that had just been on the receiving end of kindness gave more, but the predictors in what was ostensibly the earlier part of the experiment, when they were told to predict what their partner was doing, they again significantly underestimated the sort of kindness that spilled over when they had just performed an act of kindness. And I think that's interesting because people's kindness can create what you could think of as sort of a virtuous cycle of giving, but they don't fully recognize that fact.
Yeah, it's kind of a multiplier effect. It makes me think of the John Rawls thought experiment of the good society being the one you'd be willing to be born into without knowing what your position or state of life would be. You know, once these people in the study discover they're in a system where people are kind and one benefits from that, it's as though they recognize that and think, oh, well, so I'll do that too.
I think it's interesting. Because it makes sense when I describe these results to people, and yet our results suggest that in the midst of people's everyday lives, they don't seem to think of the world in this way, even though that is how it often plays out, because that's part of why we look at people's expectations. Do people intuitively get this or not? And it seems like they don't. They seem to have trouble taking the perspective of recipients, not fully understanding how positive it is for them. In the song that you were playing just a little bit ago, it just takes a moment. And so it seems kind of small from the perspective of the person who's doing the kind act. And yet it's a much bigger deal for the people on the receiving end.
Yeah, one thing you may or may not have had a chance to study yet is the validation that comes with this, too. I will say that the person with whom I share a life is way nicer than I am. I mean, she is literally the kind of person, if there's the person ahead of her in the checkout line doesn't have enough money for the stuff that's sitting there and is struggling and trying to figure out whether to take some yogurts off the belt or something, she will just open her wallet and cover it. But one thing that she's discovered is that then people just cluster around you and say, "Why, wow, you're unbelievably nice." On her birthday, you know, trucks just come up our driveway with flowers and stuff like that. On my birthday, no such thing happens. So I think one thing that's clear to me, at least experientially or anecdotally, is there are pretty strong reinforcements for kindness once you start trafficking in it.
Yeah, so I guess at least nice girls don't finish last has been your experience. And so I think the we do get feedback from people for sure. And so we have studied like the effects of people expressing gratitude to other people, for instance. It turns out that actually feels even more positive than people expect it will as well. One of the issues, though, is that the feedback is somewhat imperfect. So as researchers, we can measure on like a scale from -5 to +5. How are people feeling? And we know that they're feeling a 4 or a 5. But when you're doing something for someone else, when you're helping them with their yogurt or whatever the particular example is, you don't know, do they feel a 2? Do they feel a 1? People get that these are positive things for sure. We don't think they're going to be negative most of the time, but we don't get just how positive they are. And I think that matters for people's behavior, because if we think what we're doing is relatively inconsequential, if it's kind of a nothing, if it's not going to make that much of a difference, if it's not going to be that big of a deal, then why bother doing it in the first place? We might not take advantage of an opportunity to be kind to another person and make both ourselves and them feel better. But if we knew that it was, you know, like the nicest thing, the best thing that happened to them that day, then of course we'd do it. It doesn't cost us very much to help people in these ways. And yet there seems to be a very large benefit.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think another thing that you found is that the actual sort of tangible value of the thing being proffered in an act of niceness or kindness is not necessarily what the recipient values. If you hand somebody a cup of coffee and they don't even like coffee, you still thought of them. You saw this person. Maybe this person needs a cup of coffee. That winds up being something, as I say, correct me if I'm wrong, that people value in a way that's somewhat detached from the actual value of the thing or the act.
Yeah, that's kind of what we found. So I think what's important, so people do pay attention to what they're getting, of course. There will be differences in terms of how much people value coffee, depending on whether they like coffee or not. But I think what this insight gets at is sort of, you know, we're talking about people's miscalibrated expectations when our beliefs are off the mark. And what you're alluding to here, and that what we were interested in, is, well, why are these expectations miscalibrated in this way? Why do we undervalue the impact of our pro-social behaviors? And it's because we don't fully appreciate the role that warmth plays in these interactions, interpersonal warmth. And so when we're actors, when we're performers of an act of kindness, we tend to focus less on these feelings of warmth than targets do when they're considering this behavior. So what you were saying, the aspect of it that's correct, is that givers are really thinking about the thing that they're giving and its value. So they're thinking about, how much does this person like coffee? That's how much they're going to value it. Recipients do think about that as well, but they also think about the warmth associated with the fact that it was given to them by another person out of kindness. And so that's where there's this additional positivity that's coming, is coming from the act itself, thinking about, as you were suggesting, the fact that somebody cared about me, the fact that somebody wanted to do something nice for me, the fact that somebody wanted to make me feel happy. That has positive feelings associated with it as well, beyond the feelings associated with receiving whatever the item may be.
All right. Well, this is fascinating research. We have to stop there. Unfortunately, Amit Kumar, assistant professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. I do want to say in our final segment, we're going to be talking about regional fluctuations of niceness. Who's nicer, Midwesterners or Southerners? That kind of thing. If you have thoughts, particularly as a Connecticut person, maybe 888-720-WNPR. We will take calls today, 888-720-9677. Thanks to Amit Kumar. We'll take a little break and we'll be back right after this.
Why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you always leave me crying. I don't know why I stay home each night when you say your phone.
The technical producer of today's show is Kat Pastor. Thanks to her. And speaking of cats, today's show is produced by McCusker, the Wonder Kid, and her bad cat Penelope, who is not nice. And we're also going to take some phone calls here. They are going to be screened by none other than our senior producer, Lily Tyson. If you want to call in about sort of regional definitions of niceness, call 888-720-9677. 888-720-WNPR. Hold on, I have to adjust my headphones. Hang on. Okay, that's better. we're going to be joined now in this conversation by Jordan Green, a self-proclaimed a kind West Coaster. Mia Mercado is a humor writer and author from the Midwest who wrote She's Nice, Though, Essays on Being Bad at Being Good. So, Jordan, I want to begin with you because, in fact, I think you're the reason we're doing this show at all. It all started with McCusker the Wonder Kid seeing this Twitter thread of yours where you introduced the idea that when you describe East Coast versus West Coast culture to your friends, you often say the East Coast is kind but not nice. The West Coast is nice but not kind. And the East Coasters immediately get it and the West Coasters get mad. Explain what happened after you posted that one seemingly innocuous tweet. What happened?
My phone, I put down my phone and it got hot. Well, I wrote a whole Twitter rant because what had happened was I had had another conversation with an East Coast transplant friend, and then they were upset about sort of like these small differences between where they were from and where they were at. And I just had to tell them, like, look, people are kind here, or people are nice on the West Coast, but not kind. So they'll tell you very nice things to your face, but their actions won't necessarily follow through. And I just kind of tweeted it out. And I thought that it would, you know, get a few likes and I could go about my day. And when I got back, I put my phone down for work. And when I got back, my phone was hot. It had been retweeted and shared, and it kind of took off. It was my first and I think only viral tweet. So, yeah.
So, your phone was literally hot to the touch because it had been working so hard to deal with all the reactions and push notifications and your poor phone. I'm so nice. Yeah. I'm so nice. I worry about your phone. I'm not that nice. So, Mia, I'm going to play a little clip of from Sharp Objects. Amy Adams' character is telling Chris Messina's character about the social niceties of the fictional Missouri town she grew up in. This is C2, Kat, C2.
Educate me about Wing Cat, because I'll be honest with you, I can't quite get a handle on it.
Okay, if somebody says, bless your heart, what they really mean is, f*** you.
So I've been told by a woman who just said, bless your heart.
Let me guess, Jackie O'Neill.
She's a character.
She's sweet. Only woman who is genuinely nice to me.
Oh, come on. I heard about you, Princess of Windgap. Bow down.
I said genuinely.
And that certainly is something that we're familiar with about the South. My partner often visits Tennessee, and one time she was saying to her host about some women who had just visited, wow, they seem very nice. And her host said, oh, honey, they are as mean as snakes. But there is that kind of sense of a performative niceness that might underlie either indifference or something considerably darker than indifference. This is a question that you, Mia, have looked at also in terms of Midwesterners, who I think roll a little bit differently from Southerners, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me. I would definitely agree that, listen, the Midwest is just happy to be here. We're happy to just like be part of the conversation. If you want to call us nice, great. The Midwest definitely has a stereotype for being just in general nice, specifically fake nice. A lot of holding the door open, a lot of making sure you nod at the person you're passing on the street, even though they're a stranger. In my book, a lot of what I talk about is how this kind of niceness is a performance in itself. And I spend a lot of my time on this book trying to think about like whether my niceness is actually nice if I'm just trying to appear as nice versus like actually trying to be kind, like we were talking about earlier.
Right. So I'm going to play another clip. This is you're going to hear. This is a terrific podcast called The Run-Up. It's a New York Times podcast about a political campaign. This is a correspondent or writer for The New York Times talking about the difference in voters. This is C1 Cat.
Well, everyone makes a lot of the Iowa nice voter, right? They're taken aback by how warm and friendly they are and willing to talk to everyone. And New Hampshire has what I feel like they really are this live free or die libertarian streak. They're certainly willing to talk to you. You know, they're as engaged a voter as you find in Iowa because they get the same kind of access to candidates, so they get the same familiarity with the media. Mm-hmm. But their responses can be blunter, can be much more direct. They're definitely very different, right? They're not necessarily like evangelicals or Christians. You get a lot more in your face. There's a lot of unprintable profanity that I'll get sometimes.
So I'm going to have you both respond to that. I mean, Jordan, from a certain point of view, what we're describing is show me who you really are as opposed to who you think I want you to be. That's a kind of a distinction he's drawing. But I'd love for you to react to it however you choose.
Yeah, I love there was this study I saw online where it was like people who curse are actually more genuine in their sentiment when they're cursing. And so I love when people just like casually curse in conversations or are really emphatic with curse words. So I think I don't really have any opinion about those two places that he was talking about. But I do I have noticed that folks on the folks that I have come across who are not from the West Coast tend to be a little bit gruffer sometimes when they're like sharing their opinion. And I find that refreshing because there's oftentimes a how do I say this correctly or politely or sometimes politically correctly when you're in mixed company with folks here.
Right. I mean, Mia, I heard a little bit of your comments in those comments, too, that I played. Just kind of show me who you really are. I'd rather know that than whatever it is you think you need to do. But Mia, I'd love your take, too.
Yeah, I think we've kind of touched on this, but there is this like indirect communication versus direct communication at play when we're talking about niceness. So like I saw somebody talking about it in the context of like, a Midwesterner will say, oh man, I can't reach that thing on the high shelf, implying, hey, could you reach the thing for me on the high shelf, versus somebody who speaks a little more directly, just straight up asking the question. I think when we talk about niceness, a lot of what we're talking about is politeness and manners and specifically like obedience, which, is more to do with power dynamics at play than actual goodness. So, I think I definitely agree that there is a like a truth or believability in being direct. Like, why would somebody lie to you if they're going to be mean to you, you know?
Well, of course, first of all, I actually do believe that Midwesterners are, by and large, very, very nice. And I mean, they really kind of practice it, too. But obviously, in that same situation that you just described, the Southerner would say, oh, sure, you're so short. Bless your heart. let's hear if we get some people calling in about things. And we have two licensed niceness experts here in Jordan and Mia. Let's have them react to your thoughts. Here's Andrea in Milford. Hi, you have the floor.
Hi, nice. I'm glad to get this call in. It's funny because I just went to Stop and Shop and there was a man helping a woman pack her bags. And he goes, well, I come from Florida and we would always be doing this kind of thing. And we were commenting on, commenting online how lovely he was to help. And I moved here from Idaho 30 some years ago now. And I was a bank teller. And part of our job was to know as many names as we could for the people who came into the bank. When I moved here, the bank teller didn't seem to even look at me in the face when I came in. So those are my regional things. But now, since I've been here 35 years, I find that people respond well to niceness wherever you are. So I don't think it's...
It seems like
more nice people than there are.
It seems like a wasted effort memorizing the names and faces of people who are going to hand you identification is the absolutely first thing they do when they get to your window. But still, I get it. I get what's behind it anyway. So I don't know. Niceness experts, Jordan, you want to react to that?
I think it's sweet that people like I love when people know my name or where I become a regular at places. And I've had friends who have seen me be a regular at places and be like, oh, that's really sweet. In other places, they're just like, I hate when folks, I've definitely met folks that were like, I hate when people talk to me like they know me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just here to get a job done.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, either or. I really appreciate the Florida dude story or Florida man story. It's not often that you hear wholesome Florida man stories. And so I really like that. And I'm glad that he was helping. And
I just want to say, once you take methamphetamine and alligators out of the equation, Floridians can be very, very nice. And by the way, the people at the coffee shop know your name, definitely. They wrote Jerklin right on your cup. Mia, did you want to react also to the supermarket story?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Colin, you were talking to Carrie about this earlier, about how a lot of the social niceties that we perform have to do with coming across as likable. And I think at least in the Midwest, that is like a priority to make sure the people that you are interacting with, whether it's somebody you're going to see regularly or it's just somebody you're passing on the street, like that their perception of you is that you are a nice, likable person. I definitely relate to the idea of like, get to know all of the people that you ever meet, say their name. Yeah. Okay. No, I understand that deeply.
All right. So we're going to go to Lara. Now, we got about 2.5 minutes total, so we're all going to have to be very concise. Hi, Lara. You're on the air from Stratford.
Hi. I'll be very concise, Colin. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling with an observation. I moved to Connecticut over 10 years ago. I'm originally from Alaska. And when I first came here, I was bartending, and I would have people say to me, unprompted, where are you from? And I don't consider myself to have an accent, so I was a little taken aback by that question. Like, well, what do you mean? Why can you tell I'm not from Connecticut? And they would say to a person, oh, because you're too nice. Which is very strange, because I was essentially raised by wolves. So I'm not sure where they were getting that impression, but I take it as a compliment, I guess.
And when you're from Alaska and you say raised by wolves, you mean that literally.
correct.
All right. So, Jordan, a quick take on that?
Yeah. Shout out to Alaska. Alaska are the nicest. Alaskans are some of the nicest people I've ever met. Like, even for West Coast standards, like they're just above and beyond nice. And I'm not sure if it just comes from being up north, so far up north. I would agree with that. I could always tell an Alaskan, even in Seattle or Portland, where I lived.
So True Detective Night Country is not accurate because Jodie Foster's character is not very nice. Mia, how about you?
Yeah, I'm originally from the Milwaukee area. So I don't know, maybe it has to do something with like just awful frigid weather and just trying to get by. So being nice to anyone that's around you.
Well, go Packers, first of all. we might have let's try to do Pam real quick. We may not have time to respond, but Pam from Montauk across the bay, talk to us.
I am so glad that we're all speaking on this topic, because I feel that it's so clearly people from the East Coast are so different from the West Coast. And I say that I've experienced, I lived in New York, I live in Montauk, and I moved to LA, for a period of time.
I'm sorry.
Well, just so you know, I'm back to Montauk, so that should say it all. Because it was just amazing to me. I would go to a dog park, and in New York, you know, you sit to this person sitting next to you. And in L.A., I tried to strike up conversation, and everyone would look at me as if, like, I had an angle that I was going to rip them off or I wanted something from them, you know. And it happened repeatedly in L.A., where even going into a store, you know, I'm always chatting up, or the local bodega talking, and there was no small talk, nothing.
Right.
No.
I think, you know, Pam, I think they may have just been worried you were going to pitch a screenplay to them, which is a constant fear in LA. We have to stop now. Thanks so much to Jordan and Mia, to McCusker, the Wonder Kid. No thanks to Penelope, her bad cat. Thanks to you for listening.
I stopped caring about a month ago. Since then, it's been smooth sailing.